which is the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. So Bodhisattva is somebody who has vowed to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So this is a guide to, if you had vowed that, what you'd need to do, and then, in a way, what the expression of that would be. So what you would need to do is the whole of the Buddha's teaching, and it's divided up in many different ways in the Buddhist tradition, but in this book, just by way of a little recap, it's divided into six sets of practices, so six things that somebody who had making that vow would practice. And in a sense, even if we haven't formally made that vow, the suggestion is these are the six things that we can practice for the sake of enlightenment. So the six things are generosity, that's first, ethics or morality, that's second, patience, virya, which is energy, in a particular way, it's energy in pursuit of the good, meditation and wisdom. So this is what somebody who made these vows would practice. And they're called, well, can anybody remember what they're called? The six. Anybody who's been here?
Six paramitas.
Six paramitas, yeah. So the six paramitas, which means the six perfections, or another translation is the six means of transcending. In other words, transcending yourself. So we've been spending, so far we've kind of covered the first one, generosity, and we're moving on this week to cover ethics or morality. And there's a sort of transition in the text here, so it's a sort of transition, you could say, from vision to transformation. So it's realising, okay, we've had this, we've made this vow, we're all excited about it, we're going to save all beings. But then you realise, oh gosh, I'm going to have to actually do something about it now. I'm going to have to actually practice, even when I'm not inspired. I'm going to need a set of practices that keep me going, even when I wake up with a hangover, or even when I'm in a bad mood, you know. And that's what Buddhism says we need, you know. We can't just rely on our inspiration. Inspiration's great, but it will fade out. You know, we'll go in and out of inspiration. We need something as a sort of, well, even a discipline to fall back on when the going gets tough, when all our old habits kick in. So, yeah, he's one author's called this, called it From Promise to Practice. So we kind of made the promise, but now we've got to do the practice. So although this section is about ethics, you might have noticed from the readings that I read that actually the word ethics isn't particularly mentioned. The word morality isn't mentioned. What was mentioned, what did you notice was mentioned quite a lot, especially in the second part of the reading? So the poisons, yeah, it was mentioned quite a lot. And what quality was it saying was needed to overcome the poisons?
Almost like a warlike strength.
Yes, a warlike strength, so in that spirit, yeah.
Being like a block of wood.
Being like a block of wood was part of it, yeah, that was definitely mentioned. Yeah, definitely say that. So what quality? So maybe I'll give you a clue. So it's the same thing as I asked you to discuss over the two, mindfulness. So mindfulness is mentioned again and again as the quality. I'm sure it was. it definitely says, so I'll give you some examples. And including, it's just not possible to practice the Dharma without keeping careful guard on the mind. So it's talking about like taming the mind. If we don't keep our mindfulness, what will happen to all our other vows? And so on. Always keep a guard on the mindfulness at the door of your mind. So it's sort of repeated that. I say many other things again. All the other things people have said is correct. So why do you think, so given that this section is meant to be about ethics and morality, why do you think Shantideva's chosen to focus on mindfulness?
Because it's so easy to just sort of do something without even thinking. I didn't mean to speak quite like that.
Do people recognise that? So, anything to add to what Todd said about why he's...
I think mindfulness, whenever I experience it, which is not very often, it gives you a sense of real integrity.
So that, okay.
Linking up what you really are seeing in that real stark reality and what you believe when you're seeing, so linking things up like what you think and what you say and what you do. Kind of integration, so you're acting with integrity.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, great. I think those two responses between them have covered two of the main things that Shantideva is going on, two aspects of mindfulness that he's going on about in these chapters. It's actually, we're doing actually two chapters tonight, chapter 4 and 5. So the qualities, actually could you flick this over for me? It's a bit awkward. We've had to use a table instead of a flip chart. So if you flip, that's good. So there's three different translations of mindfulness, at least three. So one of them is smriti, quite hard to say word at the bottom. I'll say what that is in a minute. Another one is apramada, which means non-heedlessness. So that's the kind of mindfulness that I think is evoked by what Todd said. It's non-heedlessness. And so I'll explore in a minute why it's given them the negative. Like pramada is heedlessness. We've got double negative and non-heedlessness. It's kind of the mindfulness that we need to, if we're going to try and not let that thing just come out of our mouth in that heedless way, you know, the way that we've said it and we can't take it back. So that's one quality of mindfulness. And then there's sampranyana, the guarding of awareness, but also continuity of purpose. And I think that's very much what I got from you were saying about the integrity. It's like seeing how everything links up. We've actually, you know, we've decided we want to practice in a certain way, but how do we link up all our thoughts, our emotions? How do we have a continuity or an integrity between them? So that's sampranyana. Guarding of awareness, a continuity of purpose.
How to walk the talk.
How to walk the talk, exactly. Then you could call that walk on the talk. I think that would be a good way to sort of gloss it. That's walk on the talk. And then smriti is smriti's mind for the mindfulness. The sort of when we talk about mindfulness is simple awareness, of, say, our bodily sensations, mindfulness of the biscuit as we're eating it, that's smriti. So I think it's quite important to sort of, in a sense, remember these three types of mindfulness. I would even hazard to say that it might be even more important the more we practice, the more we meditate, because once we practice something like the mindfulness of breathing, we get quite used to thinking about mindfulness in a particular way. Then maybe if you just ask the general public, what does mindfulness mean? I hazard to sort of say that the general public might have a broader sense of it. If you look up the word mindfulness in the dictionary, and you look at its order, I just did look up in the Oxford English Dictionary. It says, full of care, heedful, thoughtful. So that's what the word means in general parlance. We get quite used to it in a particular way, which means, being aware of the biscuit while you're eating it, etc. That's not wrong, but we're in some dangers that I'm going to explore if we think that's all mindfulness means, yeah? Does anybody know what the last words of the Buddha were?
With diligence.
Heard a little chorus there.
With mindfulness strive on.
With mindfulness strive on, yeah. So that was a... can anybody guess what word he was using? Apramada or Samprajnana or Smriti? If you had to go... It's Apramada. So that was what... The last word of the Buddha... And again, I think it's quite important to remember that that's the mindfulness meant. He meant with non-heedlessness strive on. Yeah? So if we look, could you flip back to our little list? Actually, maybe I'll get you to do some writing. That's the one behind, sorry. And maybe we could look, I've been so good during the tea break, I've cleared up. So maybe we could just put a little letter beside it. So, Apramada, non-heedlessness, Samprajnana, continuity of purpose, and Smriti, which is kind of mindfulness in the sense of simple awareness. Maybe we'll just look at the ones we wrote. So non-judgmental mind. What do you think that would come? Do you think that would be out of the three of them? Got a few chorus.
I would say, is it Smriti?
Smriti. I think it's more Smriti, because actually Apramada is judgmental. Actually, you're making a judgment. You're saying, is this skillful or not skillful? So it's not non-judgmental. Yeah. I haven't got time to argue, see me later, but let's put Smriti. Yeah, but Apramada definitely has got a judgment in it. What about expansive awareness?
Smriti?
Yeah, I think it probably is, isn't it? So what about noticing being present? Smriti, yeah. And then we've got being present again. So then there was mindfulness as habit, I think it was meant as positive habit. Apramada, couldn't it? That could be, or it could be Samprajnana. Yeah, it could be all three of them, really. You could have all three of them. But you could create a positive habit of all three, couldn't you? A Venn diagram, yes, we do, don't we? What about being engaged?
Samprajnana.
I think it could be Smriti or Samprajnana. Yes, let's put them both down. And then what about intention before we speak or act? Apramada, yeah. So that's the non-heedlessness. And then what about non-autopilot?
Samadhi.
I think that could be Apramada as well. We're learning a lot tonight, aren't we? And then aware of emotions.
Smriti,
yeah. And then clarity. What we're getting, I think maybe all three, do you think? Mm-hmm. Could it be? Yeah, put that down as all. Yeah.
So you said clarity?
Yeah.
I'm not sure about Smriti being clarity.
Okay. Oh, well, maybe not Smriti then. Take Smriti off.
Smriti.
Okay, the other two. Okay, and then... Oh, actually, it was clarity of body, feeling and thoughts. Okay, so it is Smriti. Actually, it's the other one.
Clarity was ours.
Oh, clarity was yours. Okay. Well, what was body, feelings and thoughts?
That's Smriti.
It was concentrate about
awareness of.
Awareness of, okay. Yeah. Okay, I hope this doesn't end up a fight. This fight. Yeah.
Smriti. Very wonderful.
And then what about freedom from self?
Too hard, that's it. That's smirty, isn't it?
Okay. Okay, well, it'd probably take us a session to even unpack what that meant, wouldn't it? Freedom from self. Well, maybe if it means freedom from selfishness, it would have that ethical dimension, wouldn't it?
There is a hint of vision there, isn't there?
Hmm?
There is a hint of vision, of view, right view, in freedom of self. That's why I thought it was something else. You're responding to a view that actually it's good to be, you know, the self is something to be free of.
Okay. Well, let's leave that one to ponder on then.
That's
anatta,
isn't it?
Yeah, because we could, as I say, we could spend a whole evening on what that even means, you know. But I just wanted to do that quite quickly, just to say, well, I think I'm glad we've got a range, you know. I'm glad we've, in the ones we picked, we've got all three aspects of mindfulness. And I particularly want to draw our attention to apramada and sampajnana for the rest of the evening. I'm hopefully going to be using the text from the Bodhicharya Avatara, but I'm also going to be using my old favourite, Know Your Mind. And just tell you what Bhante says about each of them. He's got a particularly large amount to say about sampajnana. But I'll start with apramada. So he reminds us, Bhante reminds us, it's the last words of the Buddha. And what he says is... And this is the same as chapter 4 of the Bodhicharya Avatara. He says, apramada means mindfulness in a special active sense. It's to keep up mindful attention in order to guard against unskillful action. So it's very particular use, yeah? So, pramada, always in Sanskrit and Pali, means not, it means the negation. So it's not pramada. Yeah? Oh yeah, that'd be good. So it's not pramada. So pramada means drunkenness. It means a state of drunkenness. Or you could say inadvertence or carelessness or laxity. But I think drunkenness is quite graphic. So the negative bit, the ah, what it means is the least amount of pramada. So this is quite interesting, because what it's getting at is that apramada doesn't mean that we've been able to eliminate pramada, the drunkenness, completely, but we've been able to reduce it. And he says all the time, inattention and errors are trying to get hold of us, but our mind keeping alert all the time is trying to drive them away. This is actually Bhante quoting from a Bengali poet, actually. So it's quite interesting, because in this Bengali poet, and in Bhante, and in Shantideva, you've got this kind of quite warrior-like, as someone was saying, attitude, I wondered what people thought of that. You've got the three of them all kind of saying that, so you've got this... You've got this notion of errors are trying to take possession of our mind. It's interesting, this Bengali poet is using almost the same language as Shantideva, that these poisons, these unskillfulnesses are trying to take us over, and we've got to, with our vigilance, fight them. How do people respond to them? That kind of language. It's not that popular in some spheres. Yes, Lucy.
I find it a little bit confusing. Yeah. Something around kind of, especially meditation, by not trying too hard.
Yeah.
The machine enforcing yourself.
Yeah.
It seems to be implying that you need to push.
Uh-huh.
Which seems to kind of go against unfolding.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a different notion than unfolding, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
I think it's something about the self-sufficiency of the warrior.
Okay.
Appropriate of, not complete isolation, but being able to do something with limited resources, maybe in difficult conditions.
Okay.
To me, that makes sense.
Okay, yeah, so something about resourcefulness. Or, yeah, so it speaks quite positively to you.
Yeah, in that respect.
Yeah, in that respect, yeah, okay, yeah, so we've got one, two, yeah.
It's so crystal clear that the power of those emotions I've seen within myself, I've seen within friends who've killed themselves, that the strength of those emotions can be so strong in the moment, that reaction, that you've really got to, you need something powerful. You can't just, when they're that fierce, you've got to put something in the face of that.
Okay.
Put a stop to that.
Okay.
You can invoke the Buddha or whatever.
Right.
The wild elephant or the lion.
Yeah.
Surrounded by a crowd of foxes.
Yeah.
Fighting them off. I mean, it's so real. We're talking about that moment when it's when people knife each other, when they fall over someone's head.
So that's quite...
At that moment, those reactions are so strong. Yeah. That's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, you've got to put a stop to it. Yeah.
Stop.
Yeah, but it's interesting when you said put a stop to it, and I really responded, you said you could invoke the Buddha, so I don't know if that slightly tied...
No, that comes later.
That comes later, okay.
Stop it first.
Stop it first, then invoke the Buddha. Okay, that comes later. Okay, yeah. So it definitely speaks to you, again, positively. Yeah. So yourself?
I was going to say, for me, it sort of creates this idea that there's a lot of energy to it and a sense of urgency, as you say.
Yeah.
But I was also thinking, as soon as you said about those kind of real critical moments, whether or not actually you also need that energy just in the day-to-day, the run-of-the-mill stuff, because there's an urgency there.
Okay.
You might not do something to yourself, but you could get hit by a bus. And actually, have you been putting all the energy and not striving or pushing too hard, but that sense of, have you been doing enough?
Have you been doing enough in that moment to
go as far as you can, or have you kind of just been sort of rattling on in your day because you think you're going to live to a very old age?
Okay.
So I think there's an urgency in both the critical moments and also just in the day-to-day.
So the urgency, so it's interesting, I'll come back in a minute, Sam, because Lizzie's concern was, but surely we're told not to push, but you said, you seem to suggest that you could have the urgency, but... in a way that you said also not striving or not kind of not in a pushy way.
I think it's hard to get. Definitely hard to get, but I think there's things you can potentially do you've also got to be mindful of what you're doing. Are you doing it because you're judging yourself?
Yeah.
Yesterday you didn't do enough mindfulness, so you've got to be doing really mindful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe that's something that you've got to be aware of, that you're not doing that too.
Yeah, yeah. So that's good, isn't it? Because it shows with all these things, they've got a plus side and a negative. It can slip into, that's good the way you said it. If you're just using it to punish yourself, that's not positive. But if you're genuinely aware of the urgency and the danger of the negative, then it can be appropriate, yeah? So I think that's why actually Dharma practice demands so much of us, because it demands us to use our intelligence all the time. We can't just kind of go, all right, this is what I'm going to do all the time from now on. We've got to see, is it appropriate? And what's going on? Yeah. What was Sam? I'll come to do Sam, then I'll have you, and then we'll move on a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to pick up on this idea of the day-to-day, ethics in day-to-day. And the word that comes to mind is something about commitment. So the worry attitude is fully committed to whatever he's engaged with. Uh-huh. And if you take it into account, like every day, it's just a grumbling mind, like little bits of ill will, little bits of annoyance, and not allowing kind of rationalisations to come in and kind of support those. So it's like a commitment to say. None of these negative states are justified.
Yeah.
So that's quite a big commitment to make, I think.
Yeah, commitment's good. It reminds me when you were talking of, you know how people have heard the teaching on how to work with the hindrances in meditation. There's a variety of responses. So you say you're trying to do metta, but you're actually assailed by ill will. You can try... a number of different things. You can try cultivating the opposite. You can try a sort of blue sky mind where you just allow the thoughts and feelings to just float past. You can, what else can you try? You can try considering the consequences. If all those don't work, you can try what's called suppression. And it's very clear to distinguish that between repression. And again, I think maybe, again, what you were saying. So it's not, repression means unconsciously pushing something away. Suppression means just going, you know, tell you what, I'm not going there. It's a firm, committed no, you know.
A block of wood.
Yeah,
suppression
yeah.
Is,
yeah.
I'm
going to be a block of wood, but you do that consciously. You know, it's not that you're literally, well, obviously you're not literally turning into a block of wood, but even you're not just kind of going, oh, I can't handle this, I'll just freeze. That would be unconscious repression. But you're just going, I'm going to have to just put all my attention into not losing it here, or else I'm going to create something so bad there'll be no going back. Yeah? Yeah.
I was going to just tie something else. There's a couple of occasions.
Yeah.
I'm not a violent person. I haven't been violent, but there are two occasions where one was, I could have been violent. Yeah. Well, two occasions I could have been violent for different reasons.
Yeah.
And partly, I'd say that I have accepted, like, the law of karma,
yeah,
of cause and effect. And really, what was really quite there, the first, if you talk about a thought or rationalisation to stop me acting, was, no, I don't want to create that.
That
was like almost like the first next thought that came, like the impulse, and I think, no, I'm not going to go.
Yeah, yeah. So that's considering the consequences, though, quite clearly.
But there had to be an acceptance that that was real.
Oh yes, that's
before
that. So that's why
the algebra at the time.
Practice
feeding into challenging moments.
Yeah.
So without even having to actively practice in that moment, that's it infiltrating the way you think, which is amazing.
So sorry, I didn't quite hear what you said. Maybe if you can talk to the front.
I was just saying that that's obviously that moment where you read about karma and you meditated on whatever you've done and accepted it. So it's infiltrating every day way of thinking.
Yeah.
It's not just in that moment going, well, I must be.
Yeah, yes.
I must be really mindful here.
Yeah.
It's the way that you now think because you've really put it into practice, wonderful.
And that's what we're trying to do, and I think that's, we're trying to move from, there's this teaching, and actually he refers to it in here, of listening, reflecting, meditating. So you hear the teaching, you reflect on it, and then it becomes more and more part of your being. That's what it means by the meditating part, is actually it starts to become more second nature. It's gone from just something here, it's got to start there. And then you've got to buy, going over it and, reflect. Okay, I'm going to, I know there's lots more we could say on just this, but I'm going to move on. So this is all to do with, apramada, inattention and errors are trying to get a hold of us. But, and we've got to be on the, the sort of lookout, even in quite a warrior-like way. I liked your thing about the warrior's very resourceful, you know, so I like that. It's not just brute force. It's kind of, what resources can I use? So according to this Bengali poet that Bhante is very taken by, the apramada is expressed in its negative form. So rather than saying heedfulness, it says non-heedlessness, because it's not a quality that is achieved, but it's a process or activity we engage in. Yeah, and that's because, he says, because things are constantly happening to us, I mean, life's just throwing things all the time, isn't it? Then we have to be continually on our guard. So again, interest in this warrior language again. Continually taking precautions against the ever-present possibility of being taken unawares. So it's the quality of being on the alert for interruptions, temptations and unskillful states. And a bit like you were saying, Bhante says it's of crucial importance. And he goes back to the Dhammapada, another ancient text, the word of the Buddha, which suggests in one of its verses that is the literal difference between life and death, just like you said. So the Dhammapada says, non-heedlessness is the basis of immorality. Negligence is the state of death. So you've got this kind of real crucialness to it. So that's the Appomattox, or ethical vigilance. So Shantideva devotes a whole chapter to that. So I'll just talk a little bit about the chapter, just remind us what we heard so far. We won't have much time to discuss this, but we'll have more discussion in a minute. So basically, what he's saying is, in the previous chapter, a resolve has been made, and what we're realising now, okay, the spiritual life's not going to be easy. Now I've made my resolve, I've got to try and keep it. And as ever, he reminds us, there was quite a long section in reminding us, well, when will this opportunity come again, that sense of urgency. Like, here we are, okay, everything might not be, like, totally brilliant, but we are alive, we are living in the time where we can hear the word of the Buddha, we've got freedom to practice it, we've got at least enough health to kind of get us here of a Monday night or whatever, at least enough money to get us here of a Monday night. If we don't act skillfully now, you know, we might regret it later when circumstances might change at any minute to make it much, much more difficult for us. When I was rereading this morning, I was very struck by something I remembered. One of our older members called Vidya Mala, she's written a book called Living Well with Pain and Illness, and she herself at a young age, maybe in her early 40s or late 30s, was struck down and is now in a wheelchair. And everybody thinks she's wonderful, and she is wonderful, everybody thinks she's wonderful, because she's written books on, she's developed a whole course of living well with pain and illness, read books, she's really inspiring. And she once said, everybody says I'm really inspiring for the way I practice. She said, but the really smart thing would have been to practice harder before this happened. You know, and I thought, well, she could say that, because, you know, and she said, that's the really smart thing to do. Don't wait till you're struck down in a wheelchair and then, you know, she said, do it while you've got, like, these conditions make it, obviously you can practice the Dharma tests in any situation, but some conditions, you know, war breaks out, or, you know, you've suddenly got, you know, no money, or you've suddenly, you know, are struck down by a serious illness. Yes, you'll still be able to practice, but, you know, the conditions are going to be more challenging. So, and then you've got this image of this condition, it's as rare as this yolk, as a wooden thing, not yolk of an egg, wooden thing floating, and a turtle poking its head up every 100 years, putting its head through the yolk. You know, so that's kind of trying to give us a sense of how rare it is to have these circumstances. So basically, practice is hard, we're going to have to call on our mindfulness, we're going to have to be warrior-like, we're going to have to put up with hardship. And again, Shantideva said, well, other people put up with hardship, you know, warriors do, farmers do, come on, like, he's talking to himself, you know, as much, so he said, well, I've said I'm going to be a bodhisattva, surely I can put up with a bit of hardship. And then he talks about the words that I've said was the poisons of the unskillful states are the kleshas. So they are, the kleshas kind of means the poisons, it means greed, hatred and delusion. So they're our enemy, and although we're not used to, often we often are encouraged to have a more accepting, loving approach, but these, what we've got to remember is, well, how to say this? Well, the danger is it could sound like we're fighting a part of ourselves, but actually we're not. The actual Dharma saying we don't need to identify with these poisons. They're actually, in the end, not real. You know, they may feel very real at the time. So it's not really that we're trying to fight with something that is ours in some way, because ultimately all these mental states, whether positive or negative, are all in a sense like clouds in the sky. So it's just kind of as a way of thinking for now. We can think of these things are dangerous, I'm going to pull the stops out to guard against them. Yeah? So that's it, really. So that's basically, that's what that chapter is saying. So I want to leave that one for just now and then go on to the next chapter, which I was very interested to reread the Banshee's got even more to say about. And he's got this quite almost kind of warning us in a particular way of what Banshee's saying. So I thought this might be some interesting discussion. So we're now looking at the quality of samprajnana, or guarding of awareness, continuity of purpose. So what Banti says, he says, if you don't have samprajnana, if you have asamprajnana, if one does not stay continually aware of one's purpose and aim in life, which for a Buddhist is ultimately the attainment of enlightenment, one will succumb to asamprajnana, the opposite of samprajnana, which could be described as a sort of neurotic introspection with no clear purpose or point. So that's quite strong, isn't it? I mean, what do you think? Do you think that is, what did you say?
Sounds really familiar.
Sounds really familiar, oh great, say more. So do you know, say more.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, I suppose I'm interested in spirituality, and I have a lot of books and I read about it, and
yeah.
Always beating myself up for not being more enlightened.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's that kind of it is a constant introspection, and I wonder how positive it always is if it's not married to mindfulness. If it's a lot of reading and a lot of pondering but not practicing mindfulness.
Yeah, and practicing mindfulness in this broad way as well, I think. Because I think there's definitely reading, kind of, but even I would dare to say, well, what do people think? Do you think meditating itself could become, do you think there's a danger in meditation that could lead to neurotic introspection with no clear purpose or point? Yeah?
I do get it thrown at me occasionally, like navel gazing.
Right.
No navel gazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that maybe is more of an impression because people don't see, like, it has a purpose.
Yeah. Okay.
So, I think if the impression of what you do on the cushion is sit there and look in on yourself without having this bigger purpose, I think that's for me that maybe could make a difference. If you don't have a purpose, you're just doing it.
Yeah.
What's the point?
Yeah. So what do you do, so if I can push a little bit, so when you sit down to meditate, Todd, do you?
Pressure rise.
Yeah, do you remind yourself of your purpose, or do you?
Yeah, I have little markers.
Oh, yeah.
For me, it's like how much constant effort do I have to make to constantly push down, not push down, but prevent my mind from going off in negative trends. Mm. So that's my purpose for sitting, getting up at 6.
Okay.
My purpose for getting up at 6 is because this is to prevent my mind from going into negative states during the day.
Okay.
And I've done it and not done it enough times to know the difference between the two.
Yeah.
So for me, it's very evidence-based.
Yeah, well, that's great, though, isn't it? And what if I just, if you don't mind me just pushing that a bit more, so what's wrong with your mind getting into negative states? Why not let your mind get into negative states?
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
It doesn't take me anywhere with other people.
Yeah.
It leaves me feeling isolated, and it leaves me very reactive.
Yeah.
I don't like myself when I'm in negative states.
Yeah.
So
Yeah. So it's got an effect on yourself and the world around you, and it's a lovely answer you've given, that the importance of reminding ourselves why we're doing, which we might do verbally, and we might not literally do it in words every time, but it's finding some way of connecting with that bigger purpose. So for some people, it might be some of us chant the refuges and precepts, for example, before we meditate, which again, it's easy for anything to turn into a habit, isn't it? But at its best, you're reminding yourself, well, I'm doing this because I want to go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and because I want to keep the precepts, you know. So there might be other reminders, yes.
When you define Sampradayana as continuity of purpose, yeah, and integrity, that seems more the domain of wisdom, development of wisdom.
Yeah.
And studying the discourses.
Well, it could be development, but it could be, development of wisdom would be one, it could be the development of compassion and so on.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's more conscious, yeah.
A purpose is a little bit, this is a bit more of a deliberate thing. So much more, the other two seem to be more the realm of meditation practice, so that's what you're trying to develop.
Ah, I see, yeah.
Gap between
action,
physical, and that seems more the realm of meditation, that's more the realm of these teachings and this.
Yeah, but I would say meditation practice is what is within the bigger thing of what you're saying. So it means that I'm trying to get at is whatever. Yes, we meditate and that's really important, and we practice mindfulness and that's really important, but if we don't keep it in that bigger context of the development of wisdom, the development of compassion, well, certainly Bhante suggests in terms of there can be a danger of we just can get lost, you know, and I'm sure I've done it. I've certainly feel like I've witnessed that, a sort of getting lost and getting a bit precious, you know, a bit kind of over concerned with one's own kind of needs and sort of preferences. I mean, it's funny because the very point of being a Buddhist is to try and let go more, and sometimes, I mean, we always joke here that most people before they come to the Buddhist centre just drink one kind of tea, and then after a few years at the Buddhist centre there's all these different kinds of tea to choose from, and more and more people get particular about what kind of tea they have, you know, and I think that can be it's like a near enemy of anything that's introspective, is you can get more and more delicate rather than more and more robust. I mean, the idea is we're trying to become more and more robust, but taken wrongly, I think there is a danger, taken wrongly, mindfulness and meditation can end up making us kind of more delicate and more fragile rather than more sort of strong and robust, not in an armoured way, but just able to just handle life, you know. And I think that might be what Bhante's getting at, so I'll say a little bit more of what he says. He says, if one does not bring one's activities of body, speech and mind into line with one's discriminating awareness, that's why I said it was there was judgment, and one's faith, that is, if one's approach is purely psychological, one will come to grief. If one is careless or cavalier with regard to ethics, no amount of discriminating awareness will save you. The point is, it's possible to examine and analyse your mental states without actually being mindful or watchful with regard to them, any more than to your speech and physical actions. So if you're preoccupied with your mental states in this unhealthy, even neurotic way, to such an extent that you don't heed the ethical implications of those mental states, in terms of your actions of body, speech and mind, then there'll actually be an overall deterioration in your level of being. Yeah? So that's quite a strong warning, isn't it? That actually, well, I think what he's saying, to paraphrase, is You can't just become aware of your mental state and so look, now I feel that. You've actually got to realise that even your mind and your actions of mind have a consequence just as much as your speech and your bodily actions, yeah? So if you, you know, if I just let my mind rehearse arguments and stuff and just, you know, I might have a nice time thinking, oh, look what my mind's doing now and it's doing this. I can, you know, I can be aware of it. But if I'm not actually actively trying to do something, doesn't mean forcing it, do something to change that, then I'm going to deteriorate. And I'm in danger, and I think deteriorate in that way of becoming sort of more sort of self-indulgent or something, is almost... It's the exact opposite of what we
think. You become hypersensitive.
Yeah.
Hypersensitive.
Yeah.
I've definitely experienced that, you know, being so mindful and noticing every single reaction.
Yeah.
I mean, I even, for example, I even noticed when we were meditating, a phone buzzed.
Yeah.
And my heart rate just raced it's sort of taboo or whatever.
Yeah.
And noticing stuff to that level. It's so, that can be exhausting, so having the purpose as well.
Yeah.
To kind of say, okay, what does this, it depends on what situation, but how can I use this mindfulness to create clarity and create and kindness and love and all that.
Yeah. Yes, I think you've summed it up very well. It's almost like that is a danger, isn't it? And again, it's a near enemy that we get so hypersensitive, we become more the kind of, fragile than ordinary people have never meditated in the first place. And two things struck me when you were talking. Like, one is, I remember being on retreat with somebody, and she said that people sometimes say at the end of a retreat, I'm really sensitive now and I'm really open, going out to face the world is going to be really difficult now. And she said, and I've never forgotten it, she said, if you think you're too open at the end of a retreat, you're not open enough. Like, if you were really open, you could just go out and again, like, nothing would jar you, because actually you would be, again, not in a rigid way, not in a kind of, I know I'm so armoured that nothing can jar me, but just in an open way of, like, nothing's going to knock me, yeah. And I always remember that. If I think, oh goodness, you know, I've been doing all this meditation, I'm so sensitive, I can't like go to the supermarket or something. Actually, that's not a positive thing. I mean, yes, you know, don't go out to a party the night after a retreat, but you know, we should be able to like handle life, you know. And I just want to come to you in a minute. And I remember actually one of these. I know we're not trying to use science to prove everything, but they did measure the brain waves of some monks who meditated, and actually even loud noises weren't making them jump and stuff, and I suppose that's because they were really meditating. If you're really meditating, actually a loud noise, you just kind of somehow, you'd have a broad enough awareness that loud noise would come and it would just be like a little wave ripple on the big lake of your being, you know, just be like... But notice that your heartbeats and think, okay, that's interesting. Yeah, so you were going to...
Yeah, I just wonder if this issue we're talking about is something to do with ethics and ethical thoughts or actions or speech.
Yeah.
It's always a question. It's never something you're completely sure about. But sort of acting ethically, thinking the way you're asking a question, and you're looking for evidence, hopefully that evidence will back up the fact that it was an ethical action. But I think there's a fact that these ethical thoughts and actions are these kind of questions and these offerings into the world.
Okay, yeah.
It means that each time you do them, it tells you something, and perhaps hopefully reinforces a thought or a feeling.
Yeah.
But just being clear, having clarity, thinking about it, I have thought about it. Not asking that question perhaps means that you won't get any more evidence.
Yeah.
And your evidence base is fixed.
Yeah.
And therefore you can't move on.
Yeah. Yeah, so you get feedback from the world basically is what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. And then the artist to have the you know, to really be sensitive enough to the feedback and become more sensitive enough to it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think there is some, yes. So we put our actions into the world. So that's kind of the ethics of effect. But I think there's a part of ethics that's also intention. That actually the more skillful state of mind we can create, then the more the actions that spring from that will be more likely to be skillful. So it works both ways. That each is, it's like a
constantly improve.
Exactly. Like it's a positive feedback loop or a negative one if we're unethical.
Yeah.
You know, if we're coming from greed, hate and delusion, that'll create a negative feedback loop.
Or if we act unethically and then ignore that
evidence. We'll dig that rut more deeply. Then we'll be more likely to act even more unethically the next time. We should just look at what you've said completely ties in with what Bhante says next. So he says, okay, so this is a stern warning. So he says, this is because our level of being is determined by our volitional actions, whether they're skillful or unskillful. Actually, it's exactly what you said, not by whether or not we feel good while we're doing it. And he says, you can tell me whether you agree with this or not. He says, unfortunately, there is a tendency in the West to be far more concerned about the complexities of our inner psychological states than about the much simpler questions of how to live an ethical life. Mm-hmm. What do you think? True? Not true? Mm-hmm. Yeah, murmur of agreement?
I was actually going to say there's something about having a regular practice of developing being other regarding rather than self-regarding. It helps the
I think that's why generosity is mentioned as the first of these paramitas. And it's often said that if you can't remember anything else about the Dharma, just be other regarding actually. And the rest will kind of come out in the wash, yeah. Because it's so strong. I mean, at the end of the day, both self and other will discover when we're enlightened our illusions that there's no distinction. But at the moment, we're so biased towards self, even in a negative way, even if we feel we're always being down on ourselves. It's ourself we're being down on, you know. There's still a sort of, it's still me that I think is the worst person in the world, you know. I think exactly what you've said is right. If we can just practice being other regarding, that'll work against any tendency to that, to sort of introspection going wrong, you know. And it'll help to, it's almost like we need both, like, it's like meditate as much as you can, but make sure you're doing as much action in the world as well. Like, you know, if you really love meditating, make sure you do action in the world as well. You know, and the other's true, if you love acting in the world, it's important to then meditate so that you can do that wisely. So you're always in the Dharma as well, getting these correctors for each other, you know. Yeah, and again, that's where we can use our intelligence. So what else did he say? Oh, just 5 more minutes left. So I haven't really gone into the verses, but in a way, I think we have in another way. I think what Bhante says is what Shantideva's, you know, they're on the same page, as it were. So, finally, Bhante says, he says, it's true that Buddhist ethics are ethics of intention, but this doesn't mean they're simply about how we feel. Rather, they're about our intention with regard to objective situations. That's exactly what you said. If we're to act skillfully, we need to focus our intention on the objective situation rather than ourselves and how we feel about what we're doing. He says, it might be reasonable to expect to get something out of what we do, at least occasionally, but the paradox is that we're going to get something out of it only to the extent that our focus is on not getting something out of it. Yeah, so that's how he ends up. And, you know, basically, yeah, this is what Shantideva is saying. We've got to keep saying, we've got to keep a careful guard on the mind. You know, the very evocative images, like just like a wounded man in the middle of a rough crowd guards his wound. You know, we need to guard our mind in bad company. So basically what he's pointing out there is we are really influenced. Maitreya Banda talks about this. We're just influenced by what we surround ourselves with and who we surround ourselves with much more than we think. Much more than we think. And it's almost like that's just the fact of the matter. We might as well take that on board. And then, I mean, ideally, if you were a Buddha, you would, whatever company you were in, you'd be able to be skillful. But for us, that's why we have Buddha centres, that's why we have Sangha, that's why we have retreats, to at least some of the time, hopefully, not that, you know, nothing unskillful ever happens there, but hopefully at least to be in the company of people who are also trying to work with their minds. That can help us. While we're still in training, it makes sense to put yourself in the best situations for mindfulness as you can. So just sort of know what situations are sort of danger points, you know, in advance. So that all comes under this continuity of purpose. It also comes under heedfulness. Like, just think, you know, I think, okay, if I go and, you know, when I go and stay with my family, you know, there's not so many opportunities to meditate. If I don't meditate, I can slip into those negative memories. So what could I set up in advance just to, you know, give myself a bit more of a chance, you know? Or, I don't know, I'm going to be going abroad. It's harder to be vegetarian in kind of, you know, those French restaurants. But can I set something up in advance that helps me so that in that moment, I will always just take the path of least resistance, or often will take the path of least resistance. So think about it in advance. Don't just, sometimes we can just like hope for the best, like I'll try my hardest and hope for the best, but that's probably not the most intelligent approach. It's intelligent to know where our limits are. Sometimes we might need to act like a block of wood as a sort of temporary measure, a skillful means to stop ourselves doing something that we really regret. Yeah, Shantideva, he's kind of exaggerating a bit for effect in a way. It's not that literally all the time we should be going around with blocks of wood, not hearing or feeling anything, but sometimes, you know, another more kind of less dramatic image might be sometimes you've just got to cross the road. Sometimes you think, I just know I'm not going to be able to stay skillful if I meet that person. For now, I'm just going to have to cross the road. If I keep practicing doing the metta bhavana, one day I will be, but I know myself well enough just to know. Yeah? So this is, that's the training. That's those two verses. Cultivating mindfulness. Smriti is, you know, that sort of simple awareness of our body, its feelings, that's the, you know, that's important, that's the bedrock, as it were. We won't get anywhere without that, but at the same time, remembering it's not just that, it's to include apramada and sampranjanya as well. And that's what, when we say mindfulness, just remembering all those qualities. So, that is it for this evening. So we'll be continuing next week with
Kshanti.
Kshanti, is that? Yeah, Kshanti next week, or patience, yeah. Great, so hope to see you next week. Thank you.